We started the Gospel of John back in January, spent a couple weeks in it, took time off for Lent, and now we're back for until about July, I think we're going to be here. And so I wanted to kind of reorient us, and then we're going to move to our passage this morning, which is in John chapter 2. You can start turning there if you want. It's page 800-something. If somebody wants to yell that out, that's fine. So where we've gone so far is we've covered the intro. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. We covered that and some things about John the Baptist. And then we covered the story of Jesus turning water into wine. And if you remember, we said that story is part of the introduction because it's about this symbolic act of Jesus doing something new, that there's something new afoot, and that story is like that. This story is very much like that one, the one we're going to get to this morning. But before we get there, I just want to remind us of why the gospel is written. And John does us a huge favor because late in the book, or the evangelist, the writer, however we refer to the author of this book, in John 20, he tells us exactly why they collected the stories they did. And it says this: Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Understand that every author has information that they don't put in the book. If you've ever done any amount of writing, that you left some stuff on the cutting room floor. There's things I could say this morning. There's things I uncovered in studying this week. I don't feel compelled to tell you everything I learned this week. That would be boring for you, and it would be fairly boring for me, right? If I just sat here and regurgitated every little thing I uncovered this week studying this passage. But instead, every author, speaker, whoever is telling you a story selects data that fits what they're after. They pick and choose the things that they're going to talk about. And what John is telling us straight up is that there was lots of stuff that Jesus said and did, and I picked some things, and I picked them with the purpose that you would believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. We're going to really, the key to this passage to me is the idea of what it means to have life, and we're going to talk about that beginning next week. That's going to come up several times later in the gospel, but next week with the Nicodemus passage and the most famous verse in the Bible, we're going to talk about what it means to have life. And so we'll get there, but that's what we're working with. That's why he selected the material he did. So would you turn with me to John chapter 2? Does somebody have a page number from the Pew Bibles? 861. It's on the same page it was last service. Thank you. Verse 13. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem, and in the temple courts, he found people selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple courts, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those he sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a market." His disciples remembered that it is written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." The Jews then responded to him, "What sign can you show to prove your authority to do all this?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days." They replied, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you are going to raise it in 3 days?" But the temple he had spoken of was his body. And after he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. Then they believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. Now, while he was in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, many people saw the signs he was performing and believed in his name. But Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all people. He did not need any testimony about mankind, for he knew what was in each person. So let's start with what we always do. Tell me what stands out to you, what seems significant, how you thought about this passage maybe in the past. What got your attention this morning? Yeah, somebody pointed out in the last service, like Eric's words, this act of rage, he had time to think it through, that this wasn't just, "Oh, here's a whip, let's whip people," but rather that this seems like a little bit more premeditated than maybe some of us have pictured this in the past. Good. Yeah, there's something legitimate going on here, but there's probably something in excess. Yeah. Yeah, the passage is somewhat ambiguous as to what it is specifically, but it could have been either or both or a combination. Yeah, good. Yeah, what else? Yeah, oftentimes I think when we read backwards, we read it and we're like, he says the cryptic 3 days thing, and we read it with, you know, where we are, our historical perspective, we're like, how could they not have gotten it? It was so obvious. But the author is telling us, in the moment, we had no idea what he was talking about. This 3 days destroy the temple, I don't know. And it wasn't until later on that they put it all together. Good. I'll come back to that briefly in a little bit. Yeah, there's never anything here where he's whipping people, but rather he's driving the animals out and then letting the doves go free. Fly, fly. What else? I was at a wedding a couple years ago where they had doves. Have you ever done this at a wedding? With this huge fear that once you open up this cage, you've got doves who have been caged. Like, yeah. Like, it was because they circle around you, and then it was weird. It was pretty. I'm sorry, that had nothing to do with this. Anything else? Wow, good. Did everybody catch that? Over there, did you hear? Can you say that again louder? I don't know how I'd summarize that well. Sure. And I know you've got the pipes to do it, so go.
What I said was that today, there's no temple, but we are the temple. And so the zeal that Jesus has for the house of God is the zeal that he has for us. So the emotion, the passion that he puts into protecting that, the zeal, the passion puts into protecting that.
That's good. I'll come back to that at the end. I might just steal that at the end and use it. Just being fair and upfront. Footnote, Seth Ben Ezra. Whenever we study, I want to do something a little bit at the meta level for just a minute, okay? Because we're going to be in this gospel for quite a while, and we're going to be unpacking these stories. And I want to help us understand that as we move through the gospels, there's different lenses that we need to look through, okay? So this is just going to be at this level, and then we'll come back and dig into the passage in a minute. There's at least three lenses, I think, that we need to look at the passage. The first one is there's this historical lens. And so this morning, we're going to look at, like, what was the Herodian temple, and when was it built, and why is this significant, and what's the significance of the temple in the place of Judaism, and what did this actually... There was this day that Jesus did this thing. What did that day look like, and how did it happen? And there's, when I say historical, I just mean, like, what are the events that actually happened back there? And so we get that by studying, and I bring as much of that to you all as I can. And then there's the second lens. And as we understand the historical lens, it helps us understand what I call the authorial lens, where the author chose this story. Remember, he told us he left some stories out, many stories out, but he chose this one. So why did he choose this one? And why is this a significant thing to help us believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that in believing we'll have life on his name? Why does this story fit into that context? Because every author edits their work. Well, good ones do. And they say, you know what, this piece, there's been times where I've written something, and I'm like, I really love this paragraph, and it doesn't help at all. And so you just take it out. Like, that's part of the editing process. And sometimes it's better to have an editor that's not yourself because you love this sentence, or you love this idea, and a good editor moves things out. So there's this question that we'll answer at times, like, why is this in the text? And in this particular text, why does John place this event in a totally different place than anybody else telling it in the life of Jesus? And I'll explain all that in a couple minutes. And then the third lens that I'll put is, and I couldn't find a better word. I changed the word about four times, but I'll just use the word devotional. That there's this devotional level at which we come to the text and we ask, what does this mean for me? Regardless of how much historical or authorial stuff I know, what does this mean for me? What Seth said is very devotional. What does this mean to my life? Now, here's why I want to say all this. Is I hear sometimes people say something like this, and they mean it as a compliment, but also this thing where we say, like, you know, when I read the Bible, I didn't go to Bible college, I didn't go to seminary, I don't read the books you do. People are saying this to me. I don't read the books you do, and I don't know about, you know, the Herod family and how they came to power and the temple, and I don't know first century history at all, and I don't know the Romans. And when Charlie says things like, do you remember from social studies class, I'm saying, like, duh, we all know this, and you're thinking inside, I'm the only one in the room that doesn't, and you're not, all right? Like, we've forgotten things. And so I hear people say to me sometimes, I don't really know the history or the author stuff, and so I just don't even know how to read the Bible. And I just want to say, going back to the sermon a couple weeks ago, is I think there's this level at which God works in us at the level at which we understand, no matter what that is. And so there's this theologian, his name's Martin Buber, and he talked about the I-thou encounter, that when we encounter scriptures, what we're encountering is God who transcend scriptures. And the scriptures are that place through which we encounter God, along with lots of other ways that we encounter God, but that's one of the ways that we encounter God. And so what he says is that that's the important space. And so when we read the Bible devotionally, when we read the Bible, and you may not understand all this stuff, but there's this thing where, boy, this phrase really means something to me here and now, that's a great thing. And in time, maybe you'll study a passage and dig into a passage, and you'll understand more of the author's point and more of the historical stuff, and it'll make it richer or shift the meaning to you. But that doesn't let us off the hook to say, oh, I'm not going to study it. And so all of that is just to say, I just want to keep inviting you all to keep reading this gospel. I've had several of you say to me, and it makes me so happy inside, I've had several of you say to me, you know what, since we started this series, I had several people during Lent say, you know, during the series I thought I needed something to read in my Bible, and so I just started reading John, because I figured it was a good place. And I want to affirm that and say, yes, if you don't know where else to read, you don't have any other structure, just read, and read ahead, and read. Next week we're going to talk about Nicodemus. Read about Nicodemus, and take it at the devotional level as much as you want, and if there's something that piques your interest, then dig a little deeper, and I can point you to places that'll help you dig a little deeper. Some of them are obvious. You want to know about the Herods? Let me just tell you. You want to know about the Herods? Just go to Wikipedia. It has a lot of great stuff. It's wikipedia.org. Thanks, I didn't know. In the moment, I had no idea because I just hit W and it's there. I just want to say that. And what we're going to do with this passage this morning is based on that. We're going to just take each lens at a time. Okay? Usually I kind of weave these together. This morning, we're just going to take a historical pass through the passage. Then we're going to take an authorial and then a devotional at the end. So let's start here. It was almost time for the Jewish Passover. Jesus went up to Jerusalem, and in the temple courts, he found people selling cattle, sheep, and doves. So we need to say something about the Herodian temple. So a brief history of the temple in Jerusalem. The first temple was built by Solomon, everybody said, and Solomon's temple lasted until about 586. Yes, you're correct. And in 586, it was destroyed by the Babylonians. Yes, very good. So that temple was destroyed, and then these two guys came along, Ezra and Nehemiah. Nehemiah built the walls. Ezra built the temple. Remember, we talked about them a couple years ago, if you were here. And they rebuilt the temple, and that temple lasted a while. And then in the Maccabees, and all that, the temple got really run down, really beat up, all kinds of bad shape. And Herod comes to power. Now, the Herods are super interesting, bloody, gory family, right? Like, he kills his own kids, and all kinds of crazy stuff with the Herods. They're bad people. But he's trying to keep peace in an area of the world that doesn't know peace that well. And he's trying to make people happy. And if you're the ruler of an area and you want to make people happy, public works in this day and age is a great thing to do, right? Build people stadiums. Build good roads. Redo university, which they're doing all summer. Good luck getting in here on Sundays, right? So like, that's the kind of thing you do if you want to keep the populace happy, is you build them nice stuff. And one of the things Herod did, his big project was beginning in 20 BC, about 20 years before Jesus' birth, is Herod began to remodel the temple. And he did everything to the temple, and he expanded it and rebuilt it and made it beautiful, and it was huge. So what you're seeing here is kind of looking at the temple, obviously, the big place up there, that's where the Holy of Holies is. And I guess, okay, in my head, I had always thought of the temple as kind of like, when I pictured this story, for example, I had thought of like Jesus coming into a church, right? Or Jesus coming into a school or that kind of space. But what Jesus is coming into is, look at the boundaries out here that kind of go off the screen. Those are the areas that we're talking about Jesus coming into. And this temple was so beautiful. So when the disciples are like, or the leaders are like, what? Look at the temple. This place is so beautiful that when Titus, the Roman general in 70 AD, marches his troops into the temple courtyard, Titus's first impulse is, don't touch anything. It's beautiful. Leave it alone. And this is a man, a Roman general, who's walked the streets of Rome, right? He's been all over the place. And he says about the temple courts, like, or the temple itself, like, leave it alone. But his soldiers are so full of battle frenzy and they've been on the road, they've been campaigning, they've been fighting, that they destroy it all kind of against his wishes and against his better instincts. And so that's the temple. But here's what I want to point at. Here's how this starts impacting our passage. The boundaries of this temple. I read this week, and then I got totally lost in this for the longest time, and I think I did the math right. If I'm wrong, somebody can correct me afterwards. About 450 yards by 150 yards. That's big. If you multiply it out, it's about 33 acres. That's where I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure. I checked it multiple times. I even did the conversion thing online, yards to acres. It's about 33 acres. Here's perspective, okay? For those of you that I'm still, some of you, right, you're still like 33 acres. When I was out farming the other day, 33 acres. This property here, bounded by University, Gale, Cemetery, apartments over here, 5 acres. So take this property times 6, and you get the scope of this big place. Now, think about this event happening. I had always pictured Jesus coming into like a church kind of thing and driving them out, and everybody knows what's going on. Everybody's talking about it. But think about it in these terms. Heart of Illinois Fair, mid-July, packed with people, packed with sounds and events and things going on, and there's sacrificing going on, and there's smoke rising, and tons and tons and tons of people everywhere. And so what we see happening likely, historically, is not Jesus cleansing. If Jesus cleansed 33 acres, if he drove out 33 acres worth of people, he'd have been tired. And it would have been a several day project thing. Like it would have taken, 33 acres is a lot, that outer, all that big space. And so what we need to understand probably about this area is that this is probably by Jesus a highly symbolic act. It happened in a part of the temple courtyards, but it's probably not him changing the whole thing. This is symbology, big time symbology. And he's choosing his place, he's choosing the time, he's choosing all this, and it's important because of that. Okay? Does that make sense? All right, so that's some about the temple. The temple project lasted longer than Herod's lifetime. It lasted until about 64 AD. The temple was destroyed by Titus in 70 AD. So it's that thing where you finally get carpet in the basement and then you sell your house, right? Like that's what happened to the temple. It finally got done and then it was destroyed. The temple then served as the symbolic center of Judaism. And maybe symbology makes it a little bit less meaningful than it is. It is the center. The temple is the center of their national identity. So what Jesus does is not something that he did in South Dakota on the plains and nobody saw it. This is Jesus doing this event on the National Mall, right in front of the reflecting pool. Right where, if you're going to demonstrate, if you're going to fly your helicopter anywhere, you fly it into the White House lawn, right? Like, that's what Jesus is doing. This is flying helicopter into White House lawn thing. Was it a helicopter, right? Is that kind of homemade helicopter? Yeah, so that's what this is. This is a place where if you want to get attention and you want to go to the very heart of what this country's about, you want to get everybody talking about your homemade helicopter, this is what you do. And so Jesus chooses this place because it says something about everything, and it's the place where you would do this sort of thing to get people talking. This whip, there's a lot of discussion about this whip, but let me give you one extreme. One extreme I read was somebody basically saying some version of, you know, Jesus got angry and used a whip, so, you know, you can't be totally non-violent because Jesus was a little bit violent sometimes. You know, like that was one extreme in the writing. The other side is people that said it was a whip of cords. So like strings, you know, like it wasn't used to whip anybody. This was a symbol. He was doing something as a symbol. We can all argue about that, whatever we want. And then a couple more things. This exchanging of money, Ted and Mandy both mentioned some of this. What's probably happening is, so let's say we're a church on the border. Just pretend, all right? And half of you all are Canadians. And we decide as church policy, we aren't taking your money with geese on, I mean, loons, ducks. We're not taking any of your loonies and your toonies. We're having none of it. We will only take money that's real money. And so what we will do to help you out in this is that out in the lobby, we're going to have a desk, and you can bring your fake money, and we will turn it into real American currency, because that's all we take. That's all that matters, because that's important to us. And so that's the beginning of this thing, that there's this legitimate thing need they had to exchange their money for temple money. There's three kinds of things that were happening here. One is there was a temple tax. Every male above the age of 20, I think, had to pay the temple tax. And Jesus clearly, by the way, isn't against the temple tax. In one of the, I can't remember which other gospel it is, they ask him about, do you pay the temple tax? And he gives them the money to go, here, go pay the temple tax. That's what we do. We support the temple. The second thing is you could give gifts. And for the giving of gifts, you needed it in temple currency. The third thing is you needed to do a sacrifice. And if you traveled from a long way, you didn't bring sheep with you while you travel, you needed something. Or the other thing that was probably happening is people would bring their animals, and then they were supposed to be animals without blemish. And so the priests are looking at the animals, examining, and then saying, like, well, this one's, you know, it's got a gray hair, so it doesn't count, and they have to exchange it for something else. And there's all kinds of hypostulizing. Is that even a word? I can't think of the word. Theorizing. Thinking. People have their own ideas about what exactly is happening here. Were they cheating the system? Were they doing more? Here's the thing that we need to know. Is that there is a level at which I think both of you point out we need some of this to happen. And yet whatever was happening in this thing, it had gone beyond that. It had gone to a point where Jesus, it was offensive. And in fact, Jesus probably wasn't alone. There's some history that tells us that Caiaphas the high priest was in an argument with the Sanhedrin about the nature and the scope of the money changing in the temple courts. That there was some disagreement even between the Pharisees and the Sadducees about this isn't right. What's happening here either shouldn't be done in this place or it shouldn't be done in this way. And there was some argumentation. And I want to ask you something. In the passage, look at the passage. Does anybody anywhere criticize Jesus for what he did? There's no criticism for what he did. They ask him by what authority, but the thinking is that there's probably at least some Pharisees, maybe most of the Pharisees, who would have applauded the act. Who would have applauded Jesus' zeal for the purity of the religion. That would have been like right up our alley. That's what we already believe. Like, yes. What gets Jesus in trouble is his response to their question, which I'll come to in just a second. One last historical detail. Let me just do it from here. Jesus says then, I'm going to destroy this temple, which nobody in the room understands. Let me just paint this as a picture of what he says. Move it to today, and Jesus is standing at the Capitol building, and he says, I will tear down this building in 3 days, I'll rebuild it. We have a word for this kind of statement. It's what?
Terrorism.
That what Jesus is saying is terrorist-like. I'll destroy it. And they don't understand. I love. Somebody pointed out. Like, I love that point where he's like, they have no idea. I imagine if you're the disciples, you range from, I can't believe you'd say that about the temple. To someone be like, there goes Jesus saying crazy things again that we don't understand. And it wasn't until, and I love the humility of the writer to say, you know what, it was after he died and we were sitting around and we were talking and then we realized like, oh wait a minute, he said that. Here's what it's like. A friend tells you that she's pregnant and then you go, wait a minute, 3 weeks ago I offered you wine and you told me you had a headache and didn't want any, but you didn't have a headache, did you, right? That's what this is they think back after the resurrection, they're like, 3 days, he said that thing, and now we totally get it. That's what's happening here. And I love that, by the way, because we often think of them as oafs that didn't get it. But how could they? So this line, destroy this temple, starts helping us move from the historical to the authorial. This line, in the trials of Jesus, if you go to the Gospel of Mark, in the trials of Jesus is accused of equating himself with God, but there's one time that they actually use Jesus' words against him. Do you know what Jesus' words against him that they use? Like, what are those words? It's that line. What they say to Pontius Pilate is he said that he would destroy the temple and in 3 days he would rebuild it. Those are the only direct words of Jesus that are used in his trial against him. They do a lot of he said, he said, he said, but then when they actually quote him, it's this line. And the synoptics assume this, and it's in John that we find that he actually says this. Which leads us into this authorial thing. So there's this big discussion. If you were open any kind of commentary on this passage, the first thing you'd probably come up against is what we call the synoptic problem. So here's the problem. We call Matthew, Mark, and Luke the synoptic gospels. They generally tell stories in the same way. They are clearly copying each other at points and then diverging at other points. That's what's happening. So those three sit over here. We call them the synoptics because they go together. And then there's John, who tells everything in an obtuse way and tells it differently, and he picks entirely different stories and is clearly not picking and choosing and copying them in any way whatsoever. So the three synoptics take this story from the life of Jesus, this cleansing of the temple, and they put it on the Sunday in Passover. The first day, I think it's the first day of the week in Passover week. Holy Week. Right? So for them, when they tell the story, it's Jesus cleanses the temple, 5 days later, he's dead. John tells this story at the very beginning of his story about Jesus. We're in chapter 2, for goodness sakes, right? Like, he moves us all the way up front. So here's two ways of seeing this. The less popular way, there's some conservative scholars who say, well, duh, there's just two events. There's one at the beginning of his ministry, and there's one at the end of his ministry. But 90% of scholars, biblical scholars, don't believe that's the case. They really just believe that there's one event. And that what happens here is that John, or the evangelist, or the writer, however we refer to him, is taking this event and moving it to the front of the story to make a point. Have you ever watched a television show or a movie? I can't even think of a good movie that does this. But have you ever watched a television show that tells the story and they don't tell it in a sequential order? They flash forward, they flash back, flash forward, flash back, now we're in the present. It was just recently, House of Cards in the most current season, there's an episode where they do this. They're telling a story, and it starts at Claire and Frank Underwood renewing their vows. I'm not spoiling anything for those of you that are watching. They're renewing their vows. But then throughout the episode, you have to figure out in each scene, is this jumping forward or jumping back, or is it the present? And there's clues going on, like her hair color changes at one point, so you know, like, oh, it's, I can't remember, I don't pay attention to hair color. But, like, so it was totally lost on me. And then there's these monks that are doing the thing where they blow the sand thing, and you see that proceeding through, and so you kind of can gauge where it's at in the story. Anybody, is this familiar? Anybody watch television? Everybody see these kind of progressions? This is what John is doing for us. In John's telling of the story, he's flashing forward to the event before Holy Week and telling us that story now because he thinks it's important that we hear this story now. And I think the reason that John thinks it's an important story now is because of that line, in 3 days, I'll destroy that temple. To understand, the early church would have understood that line came back to haunt him. That line came back at Jesus' trial. That line, there's a direct line between Jesus saying that and his death. And so what John is doing is flashing forward to let us see, here's what's happening, and then he's going to now spend the rest of the gospel going back and leading us back to that point so that he can go to the Holy Week story. Is that, you see that? Can we see all that as a storytelling mechanism? It's a really good storytelling mechanism, but when we come to the gospels and we just expect them to do chronology, we shouldn't expect that, all right? He's telling the story in a creative and important way. Two quick things. Confrontation with Jewish authorities, verse 18. The Jews then responded to him, "What sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this?" This is directly coming out of Deuteronomy 18 and 8, 9, somewhere in there, I think, where they're told that when somebody comes and does these kinds of things and sets themselves up as a prophet, you're supposed to test and see if a prophet really is a prophet. And so part of the question they're asking here is like, hey, you're doing something we probably generally like. Show us that you have the authority to do this. And they're doing exactly what they should do. And then Jesus answers his really enigmatic, the 46 years and blah, 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 blah. All right? And then finally, two other things I want to point to, and then we'll get to devotional. Verse 23. What happens in verse 23 is the author now is making his own comments. It's like a narrator jumping in. And when a narrator jumps in, you should pay attention because they're trying to tell you something. And in this case, the author's jumping in and saying, hey, I'm stepping out of the story briefly. I want to make some general comments. And the two things he points us to is that, well, I'm sorry, going back to 21. The two things he mentions is, first of all, that we didn't know all this stuff until after Jesus died. It was after Jesus died that we put it all together. We've pointed to that already. And then the second thing is down in verse 23. And it talks about this relationship between Jesus' signs that he's performing and people believing him, but Jesus being careful about their belief in him. And we're going to see this kind of unwind as we work through the gospel. Actually, I'll refer to this again next week because of the play between verse 25 and verse 1 is great. And the NIV loses it a little bit in the translation here. Let me translate it as I understand it a little bit better. It says, verse 25, he did not need any testimony about mankind, for he knew what was in a man. Now there was a man, a Pharisee named Nicodemus. So there's a really clear play on words that's happening between that and on the Nicodemus story, and we're going to tease that a little bit next week when we get there, so we'll come back because that's a bridge there that the author is doing to help us put those two stories together. All right? So, any questions, comments? How does the history and the authorial intent help us understand the passage? It doesn't. I'm going to go home and cry. Let me pull it together. I think what's happening here is I was going to ask you in the beginning, and I didn't, how do you see this passage? Because I think for me, growing up, I saw this passage as Jesus entering a room, maybe this size, angry, yelling, screaming, driving people out, whipping people. And I don't think I quite believe that anymore. I believe that this story represents this highly symbolic act of Jesus. I think Jesus really did go into a temple court. I think he waved something around. I don't know that he was whipping people. I don't even necessarily believe that he was angry. I think he's passionate. But there's a way to be passionate without being angry. And I think he's letting his passion be known. But he's also doing something at this historical, authorial level that's really symbolic to help us understand that he believes in the purity of this religion, but that it's gotten off the rails. That he believes in what God is doing, and he pays the temple tax, and he's not saying the whole system is wrong, but that the system has gotten off the path. That there's something he's going to do that's going to expose what's wrong with the system. And we'll see that tracked through until we get to the point where the temple curtain's torn into. Like, it all comes down in a house of cards. Ooh, if I had just planned that out, that'd have been brilliant. But it all comes down, right? Like, that there's something that Jesus is doing in all that at the historical, authorial level is just brilliant as the gospel goes along. But I can get geeked about that stuff, right? If you would have just met up with me on Tuesday afternoon this week and just asked me what was brewing, you would have gotten all that like a fire hose. Because I just get really excited about that kind of stuff, and that's really interesting to me. But I know for many of us in the room, you're like, that's nice. I could have read Wikipedia too. I'm kidding. I'd do more than that. But the bigger question is like, so what does this have to do with us? And I think that when we come to this devotional level, I think what Seth said is really good, that this idea of this zeal for the house, this zeal for the temple, and as the symbology of the heart of Judaism, Jesus' zeal for that and the purity of that speaks to us. There's a couple things that I think invite us in this passage into discussion. And invite us, I hope that when you leave here, you talk about it at lunch, or you talk about it with your spouse, or you talk about it in your small groups later this week, but I think there's things in this passage that call us into reflection about what kind of purity is Jesus calling us into? There's probably something in here, I'll tell you something funny in a second. There's something in here about how the church, and when I say church, I'm not even so much interested in the organization known as Imago Dei Church, but even that, but also the church as it exists in each of us as we live in the world. But there's probably something about the church and politics. I have this relationship that's growing with this guy named Matt Gross. He works for this organization called Bread for the World, and it's out of their leadership and influence that we started the summer meals, and we showed the film a couple weeks ago and some of those things. And he and I have talked because he's like, you know what? The church can only feed so many people. You can work up a lot of energy and feed a lot of people, but the church can only go so far and do so much. And he's like, there's lots of money sitting out there, and we need to petition our Congress people for money to help feed the poor. And I'm like, I'm all with you on plant a garden, but politics makes me nervous, like really, really nervous, right? And he's like, but that's how things get done. And I'm not talking about politics and power and getting control and parties and all that stuff. But there's this sense in which Jesus steps into the political climate of his day and makes a statement about how the national worship is being done. And we miss that in our day when we keep religion and politics so separate, but understand that they're so linked together, and Jesus isn't afraid to step into those things. And when we really start looking at the history of the Gospels and all those things, we find all these places where Jesus keeps stepping into the national conversations of the day, and he's not fearful. He leads into them. But the more interesting, then I had somebody between services send me a link to an article that was like, why Christians shouldn't be in politics at all. And it was funny. He didn't mean it that way, but it was interesting. So then the second thing that I think devotional level that calls me into a conversation is about church and money. In the news last week, there was this article about a church in the South. I think it's Atlanta. I don't know much about this church. But the reason they made the news, it was on Good Morning America, national news, right? And the reason that this particular church made the news is the church was doing a fundraising campaign, which isn't unusual for many churches in America, except that this fundraising campaign wasn't for a building and it wasn't for a cause. It was for the pastor's personal jet that he thought God wanted him to have. And so they were having a capital campaign in the church to buy him a jet, which I think is brilliant. I mean, if you can pull that off, that's awesome. Let's pray. What's that? So, thank you. Seriously, many of us have come from churches where we've been involved in those kinds of things before, right? And I know that part of the climate of this church is that as soon as I say money, there's some of us that we're already like, oh, here, we've gone too far. He just mentioned money. He's already said too much, right? And yet, there's this thing, and I think this passage draws us into reflection about us and money and our relationship to money. What we said earlier, they needed some of this to happen. But the why and the how and what we do and all of that gets really thorny, right? The details are important. And so I think it calls us into reflections about that. Like, here's the easy one. I'll start with easy. The easy one is to reflect on how the church spends its money. And the further you are from church leadership, the easier it is to be clear about this, right? Because that's always the way it is in any organization. The less I'm in leadership, the more easy it is to be critical of whatever decisions they make about the money. But I'll just tell you, I know in our reflections as a church, two stories. One is I remember in the early days when we were first starting out, I had been involved kind of in another church plant with another church. And we had this awesome sound system. And the way the sound system worked, because it was also a thing where we were setting up and tearing down every week, and the sound system was amazing, and it had these cool boxes. Everything folded into these boxes, like the soundboard. I know some of this doesn't matter to some of you, but I'm a geek, so let me tech geek out for a minute. You rolled out the soundboard and just took off the top, and it was just this huge soundboard already like set up. You just plug it in, and you're ready to go. And everything, then at the end of the day, everything like went back into these boxes and folded down, and it was like a transformer. You roll it back onto this trailer, and you put everything in particular. There was a diagram in the door, and you put all the trailer boxes in a certain way, and they all went together perfect in your trailer. It was awesome. And we looked into it because it was awesome. And I'm pretty sure it started around 75 grand. And we were like, whoa, we have officially collected zero and it's 75 grand, but it's cool. And that's the way it's done. That's the way church plants start. And so we had a conversation, like a long conversation about like, how much should the church, how much should a brand new church that has nothing, how much should we spend on sound equipment? And that happens in churches all the time. Like, should the church buy lights? John Gill and I had a conversation this year about we rent lights every year for Lent and Good Friday and some of our special services. And John Gill and I had a conversation about every year we spend X number of dollars renting lights. Is it better to keep renting every year or should we buy some? And so this year we did kind of in the middle. We bought a couple and we rented a couple. And we're moving to a place where we won't have to rent anymore because we looked at the math and said, well, over time, we're better to own. But that's not always the case. And so we keep having these kinds of conversations. Oh, I should finish the story. So in the early days of the church, we were lucky that we had Adam Bloom and Brian Goodman, and the two of them cobbled together a system, and Adam built these wooden boxes that are they still around or somewhere? I don't know. If they are, they've been tucked away somewhere. But we had these wooden boxes that Adam built, and we got a little system, and it still exists over there. We still use it in the park view room. And we spent $6,000, you know, and it was cobbled together, and it was kind of a mess, and our trailer kind of fit stuff in. And I think, Eric, you were part of packing that trailer sometimes, and it sometimes mostly worked. And it wasn't slick, but it worked, and we made it work. And it's because I think when the church comes to money, I think we ought to have lots of conversations. And just because we have it doesn't mean we should spend it. And out of that then started a conversation in our church about the First Fruits Fund, where we decided early on, like 10% of everything we bring in goes to the poor. Because we just thought that was, if we're going to ask people to give money to the church, and there's people that give so sacrificially, like, we ought to model that as a church. And so we chose from the beginning, like, we're going to do that. And so I think this passage invites us into those kinds of conversations about the details of how is money spent. And like I said, that's the easy one. To criticize churches for spending money is the easiest. And I know I've been in several churches, and I know there's lots of hard conversations, and it's easy to criticize from the outside what you don't know is going on the inside. But the harder reflection is about me, right? The harder reflection is about each one of us, that if Jesus were to sit with us in our finances, what would he say? That's how you use my money? I've given you these gifts, and you use them, and you make that, and that's how you use that? And it's easy for us all to start wagging fingers at each other and start going, well, you bought this house, you bought that car, you go out to eat all the time, you spend money on movies, and I wouldn't go to... Like, we all get really judgmental over the things we don't spend our money on. Can we all agree with that, right? We're all... Okay, so yesterday I told you I was at Six Flags, and I said to my dad at some point, some person walked by and they're wearing a Superman cape, and I said to my dad, I said, it's really hard for me when I'm in a place like this not to judge all the people buying all the crap, you know? But who am I to judge people for that, you know? Like, I just choose to spend my money on other things. And so what I think this text invites us into is really hard conversations in probably tender places of the soul where we're trying to be more like Jesus, where husbands and wives and friends and small groups sit down and talk about, like, what's the right thing? I have this friend, he's a pastor, and we have this conversation. And I'm going to say up front, this is not meant to indict anybody, okay? I don't want anybody to feel self-righteous. Or self-loathing is the word I'm looking for. He says to me sometimes, like, or he said to me a couple years ago, we were having lunch, and he said, Christians should never, ever drive a BMW. And I was like, okay. I said, what about an Audi? And he's like, oh, I don't care about that. Just not BMWs. What? I missed the difference somewhere back there. Like, I don't. And he's like, well, they're just a symbol of wealth, and there's no context in which a Christian should buy a BMW. And I was like, I don't know. I don't know that's true. I think that's between those people and their God and how they worship and how God's calling them into faithfulness. It's easy to criticize the decisions I don't have to make. I don't have to make that decision. That's not an option. I've got my own to make. And so this passage calls us into that kind of reflection. Is that enough? Am I giving you enough fuel to process and think? This passage, I think, calls us into reflections about what does it mean to be the church and how do we live in a relationship with money, understanding that we have to have it, we have to use it, we have to live, we have to eat, and yet there's these places even in that context where it was easy to go out of bounds. Let's pray. God, help us in these kinds of conversations. It's so easy for us to be so judgmental of others and to have zeal for how other people live in their temple. Father, rather quiet those voices in my head that want to judge everybody else and tune me in to what you want to say to me and how you want to call me into following after you. And so, God, I just pray that you would do that in us and help us to be sensitive to that and help us to know what the next step to following after you looks like. Continue as we journey through this book, God, to enrich it for us, to make it just come alive through the history and through the author's intent, and then even devotional thoughts. Help us to just really come alive in this and see how you want to encounter us, or how you want us to encounter you. And then, God, we just this morning want to remember our brothers and sisters down in Honduras. Be with them this week and keep them safe. And I'm glad that they arrived safely, and just be with them all week. Pray that there's a harmony and a beauty in that team as they work together. And bring them safely back to us. In your name I pray. Amen.